So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Here it comes. The ultimate wrestling event of the year. Available live on pay-per-view in the comfort of your own home. Starrcade 88 True Grit. Call now to be a part of the rich tradition that is Starrcade. No way out for five-time world heavyweight champion Nature Boy Ric Flair as he collides with the awesome power of Total Package Lex Luger in a no-disqualification all-out war. Plus, former friends become foes as American Dream Dusty Rhodes and Sting tag up for revenge against the might of the Road Warriors. And U.S. heavyweight champion Barry Windham takes a test of true grit as Big Boy Bam Bam Bigelow gets his shot at the belt. NWA Wrestling will never be the same, and you're going to see it all. The Midnight Express's fight for supremacy. The Russian assassins put up their identity at Paul Jones' job against the bite of Ivan Koloff and the Junkyard Dog. Plus, the Fantastics, Hot Stuff Eddie Gilbert, Ron Simmons, and an explosive Rick Steiner Mike Rotundo battle for the world television title. Spend your holidays with the best in professional wrestling, live from Norfolk, Virginia, and only on pay-per-view. Call now to reserve your ringside seat in your very own home. Starrcade 88 True Grit. 3 full hours of action, strength, and power. Don't miss it. Call your local cable operator before Friday, December 23rd. Don't miss out on this great event due to holiday vacation.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is Review Away, and I'm John Pollock. Not joined this week by Wei Ting, instead, back by popular demand, he is Dylan Gott for his, if I'm not mistaken, third review. Wow, three. That means
I can't believe it's been it's third time. First time.
You get a watch at the end of this for that. That's the honorary gift we give for our third time reviewers.
I hope there's no one. Because Wei is such a staple of podcasts, obviously it's named after him, so I feel like a lot of people are disappointed, but I'm going to do my best.
Oh, don't worry. All the disappointment is usually reserved just for me, so don't worry. They'll be kind to you.
Exactly.
But we are going to be chatting today about Starrcade 88, True Grit, with an extra T at the end, just to be as WCW as possible. The same group that decided 1R was not enough for Starrcade, we had to go double. So
yeah, exactly.
Big fan of the double letters was the NWA in the 80s.
This is because this is the last NWA event, right? Not a last NWA event, but this is like as they're turning from Crockett to WCW.
Yeah, this was a month after the sale, and it was still being called the NWA, but that was, yeah, quickly. The change was occurring into...
Yeah, you can see everything here. They got the big gold belt and everything. This is a crazy show. Honestly, the only reason I picked it is because me and my friend were watching the network, and I think... And you talk about this all the time. I think a lot of people do. You want to see something like looks different than WWE now? And I really enjoy the like old NWA format where it was like jobber match, promo, jobber match, promo, like over and over and over again. And the way these feuds start are so good, some of them. Like, the original Midnight Express versus the new Midnight Express feud starts because of a phone call.
A phone call, which got very, very bloody at the end.
Exactly.
It's a great angle.
It's a great angle.
If you've not seen it.
And I didn't realize, like, watching old WCW shows is they use the Tony Schiavone gets a phone call from somebody thing so much. Like, I never even remember it, but it's like Tony Schiavone goes like, oh, hello, we have a landline at WCW Nitro. Someone's angry at you with the Midnight Express. And then Jim Cornette answers it like, oh, go to hell. And then just, and then it gets really serious, but with like such a stupid start. It's like, it's great wrestling.
I mean, and it ties in perfectly to the end when the week before the final Nitro, it is Eric Bischoff, not even live at the arena, but by telephone, announcing next week is the season finale of WCW Monday Nitro. And just like that, we're going off the air next week forever.
It's so funny, man. Like, there's so much good stuff here. And you can see, yeah, it's the sowing the seeds of, like, what is WCW versus what is the NWA. It's great. Like, you don't have the ding-dongs yet. We're not that far into it, but there's, like...
No, but this was right as this was the final event before Jim Herd was officially in power. He had already been announced, and I think his first day was like January 3rd. So like a week after this begins the Jim Herd era, or error, as some would classify it as. So yeah, this is a really fascinating time in their history.
Before WCW and Pizza Hut become one finally.
Yes,
you know?
the Pizza Hut executive who had a role at KPLR and somehow ended up running the second biggest wrestling organization at the time in North America.
And the well-documented thing where it's like he wanted Ric Flair to cut his hair and get a diamond earring. And they were like, oh, that's so stupid. But then like 3 years later, of course, they cut Ric Flair's hair. So it's like, why not? I think Jim Herd had some good ideas.
So when it comes to weekly NWA television, have you gone back and watched some of it on the network? And did you watch any of it at the time? As I mean, you and I are kind of similar in age. So this was like before my viewing time. I think I was four at this time.
I did not watch WCW until I don't know if I've talked about this on this show, but I definitely have before a lot, is that I'm a huge Big Boss Man fan. Like, he got me into wrestling, where legitimately I saw this man and I was like, I'll probably grow up to look something like that, like a smaller version of something like that. And lo and behold, like, we kind of look the same. So I saw the Big Boss Man as the guardian angel, and that was the first time I saw WCW. So this is all like, I just kind of wanted to see what WCW and NWA wrestling was like in the 80s, because you always hear about, like, Ric Flair's great. You hear about, or you see the Road Warriors, and like, and this is like the Road Warriors.
You didn't look at Michael Hegstrand and say, one day.
Exactly. I wish I would have that much confidence as a kid. Even at like 4 years old, I knew like, I'm probably going to be dumpy with thin wrists. Like, I'm probably, that's how the odds going to work out for me. So I saw the, but like, this is all working back. Like, and you see the Road Warriors when they kind of become the Road Warriors too. Like, because before they have the look and they have their gimmick down versus like, even like 3 years earlier, they're kind of still dressing like David Bowie leather daddies at the same time. Like, there's some stuff when they, I think it was like Memphis where they're like, oh, these guys are huge and intimidating. Yeah, they're 6'5", they're 300 pounds of solid muscle. But like, that guy's wearing a choker like girls wear to clubs and like assless chaps. Like,
it was a level of balls at the time that just is not present today.
Yes,
and you can
exactly.
go back, and it's just it's remarkable to watch. I always would love the when it was just the out of the ring angles, just in their everyday dress, like Jake Roberts running down from the shower when Cheryl is being harassed by ravishing Rick Rude. It was like, what is Jake Roberts' day to day attire like from town to town?
That's the thing I really like about the NWA is that, like, they don't completely brand everything. Like, WWE completely brands everything. So, like, Roman Reigns does a sit-down interview. Roman Reigns is, of course, wearing a security guard vest. And, like,
well, duh.
Yeah, exactly. But, like, in the NWA, yeah, exactly. You see, like, the Road Warriors where it's like, does Hawk have his face paint on? Yes. Does he have, like, a Gold's Gym shirt that kind of covers his navel? Yes. But still, both somehow wearing a tank top where both his nipples are showing and his belly button showing? Of course he is, you know?
Yeah, I'm curious what 20 years from now we will view this generation's fashion as. I mean, with 2030 eyes, how will we look back at 2017 and what were the giant mistakes? Because here in the present, I can't tell. I don't know. I thought the Hardys were super cool in 1999 with their raver gear. Today probably doesn't hold up as well, mainly because Michael Hayes also got in on the
Oh my god,
well.
Michael
remember
Hayes.
That?
Yeah, I remember when the coolest thing in the world was to have as many zippers on your pants as humanly possible.
Oh, those the cargo pants with a million zippers.
But Michael Hayes just has something about him. Like, he dated Rosa Mendez. There's a really, really – I remember looking this up where my friend didn't believe that Michael Hayes dated Rosa Mendez. And I was like, yeah, look it up. And then we looked it up. And there's a really – I mean, if you're a person who compiled this website, like, they should really be found and detained, because it's like, who dated who in wrestling? Like, it's just a list. It's really – I think it's like dating.me or something like that. And it's just like, whoever compiled this list should just be like
– wow.
Like, at least sat down and had a conversation with, like – What are you doing? You know?
Like, speaking of bloody angles, because this was the tail end, and this was realistically the end of Dusty Rhodes' tenure with the promotion. And he had been about a month or so prior was when the new Turner regime was coming in, and one of the big things was either the complete elimination of blood or drastically scaling back. Because let's be honest, Dusty – Dusty loved color.
He really did.
I mean, and these performers have the scars to prove it to this day coming out of this era. So following this new edict of toning things down, Dusty, being Dusty, went out and did an angle with the aforementioned Road Warriors where they took a metal spike to his eye.
Yeah, not even his forehead, his eye.
Which, to his defense, was an incredible angle.
So good.
And did set up this tag match for Starrcade. However, he was fired as booker for this. So this was this weird period where he was in this lame duck position, ousted as booker, still performing, which also included him not showing up for a set of television tapings in the interim before Starrcade, working this match, and then no-showing a bunch of dates in early January before completely being done with the company. And then we go to Florida, and then eventually it was the polka dot era. But this was really it for Dusty, who had taken this company to great heights. But in 1988, this thing had really plummeted to the point that they needed to sell the company.
I wish I would have had the forethought to think, wow, I really picked Starrcade 88 because it's like a changing in eras.
This is a really important time period, one of the most important for the company. I mean, had there not been the sale to Turner, probably a thing would have just gone out of business,
but
which
really,
changes everything.
The whole reason I picked it is because I wanted to see the end of the new Midnight Express, original Midnight Express angle, and the fact that Dennis Condrey, like we'll talk about on the show, but Stan Lane's offense and Dennis Condrey's ring attire are two of my favorite things in pro wrestling history.
Oh, dear.
You just don't get stuff like that anymore.
Oh, man, the karate of Stan Lane. I mean, my God, had UFC been around in 1988?
Back in the 80s, like what they thought fighting was perfect.
I loved it. Speaking of just insanity, did you see the clip this week of TMZ interviewing Bubba Ray Dudley and Tommy Dreamer?
No.
Okay. I almost feel, being that you are as big a follower as I know of mixed martial arts, that I can't do justice to this without actually playing it for you, because I want to get your genuine reaction to this, all right? So this is going to be one of our interactive segments here. Let's pull up
nice
this clip.
And people get to hear how hard you type again.
Oh, yeah. I just murder this keyboard. Yeah. Okay. Somehow a shot of Sable came up here.
Yeah. There's a lot of babes on every.
Here we go. All right. So brace yourselves, folks, for some TMZ action here. And we're going to get Dylan's live reaction.
Bubba Ray Dudley, also one of my faves.
Okay. You know, Shane McMahon's a wrestler in the I don't know if he consider him a wrestler, but he's involved with the WWE, but he's wrestled some amazing matches. Do you consider Shane a good wrestler? Is he a good wrestler?
I don't know if, maybe not wrestler in the traditional sense of the word, but Shane is one of those guys that's really great at creating like that holy shit moment. Shane's crazy.
All fair points.
We're
going on a nice pace here of Shane.
We've hung out with Shane. We've drank with Shane. Shane goes out there to steal the show all the time. Shane wants to do the craziest stunt ever. I mean, he jumped
off the
Titantron.
Please give me a job. Please give me a job.
He's nuts. He legitimately wants to just
do everything.
Shane,
clip could have ended here.
Sound. Shane is very, very good. If you just watch his WrestleMania match with AJ Styles, it was a real, real good match. I also think Shane doesn't get enough credit because he doesn't have to do that to his body, and he does. And I also think the world should have Shane McMahon enter UFC because he is a real badass.
Yeah.
And he would fare well in UFC.
No.
There's a lot of guys who like to talk smack like a Conor McGregor. I would love to see Shane McMahon go to UFC because I think he would choke some dudes out or knock them out.
You think Shane could actually handle himself in the UFC better than like a punk there?
There's no doubt that Shane can.
There are many
Shane
doubts.
Shane is like that rabid pit bull that will fight until death. Like, even if like we're backstage and just kidding around and horseplaying and wrestling in the back, he has to win every single contest. You are not going to keep him down. You're going to have to kill him to beat him.
With the new ownership, how fast do you think Dana White called Shane McMahon and was like, Brock Lesnar, Shane McMahon won?
Oh.
Like, one time we worked the match, because whatever, you need WrestleMania buys, but we want UFC, like, 250 to be Shane McMahon against Brock Lesnar.
Oh, my God. Could you imagine?
That's
like
insane.
Shane McMahon and Chad Money Mendez. Here comes the money, Shane. Here's the real money.
Oh my God. Well, that's
I guess Chad's kind of on the sidelines for some time, but
I kind of identify with that, where it's like sometimes I'll do that too. Like, I did it just the other day where I had like some shows in Scotland coming up for a month, and yet supposed to tell the shows. So I did an interview, and then I said some stuff, and I just should have just stopped talking. But then they were like, the camera was still on, and Tommy Dreamer was probably like, and I'll say this too. And then it's just like, even the interviewer is like, what are you talking about? And he's like, I went three sentences too far, and you guys are going to use this because you're TMZ.
What I want is like the brain pattern as Tommy Dreamer is processing Bubba's answer. What's going to be a headline? What are people going to click on? I think we've hit a 2 on a scale of 2 to 10. Let us go all in and hit a 12. And as all of a sudden, I think he should go to the UFC.
Shane's clinch
game? I love
this.
47-year-old Shane, yes.
What division would he fight in?
Shane McMahon? How big do you figure he is? A middleweight?
Yeah, middleweight. I mean, he could just face Punk. He could just face CM Punk.
This is frightening.
Bellator would sign
I am not stating Bellator would not be all in on
if
that.
If I got, if like the chances, I talk about this all the time with my friends. If I got like, let's say I got like a TV show in the UK and I called up Bellator and I'm like, listen, I can shed some water weight and get down to 185. I want that title. Me versus Melvin Manhoef. Scott Coker would be like, yeah. Like I think Scott Coker undercover, like he seems like a really, really nice guy and really genuine guy. And Dana White kind of seems like an asshole. But like, just like Dana White made Chuck Liddell retire and Scott Coker is trying to convince people to like come back. Like, oh, you're on dialysis. Just give one more fight, Hoist. You know what I mean? Just one more fight. You don't have to wear gloves. We told you don't have to wear gloves.
I'm going to move on because I don't want the Shane McMahon to UFC discussion to have any kind of life form and it become any kind of talking point amongst people. But Starrcade 88, plenty of guys I would love to have seen in a UFC tournament a couple of years later.
There is some legitimate, like, you see Dr. Death on this show, and Dr. Death, the whole time I'm thinking, like, this looks like 80s Brock Lesnar. Like, this guy was a boulder.
So this Starrcade as well, everyone knows the tradition of Starrcade in Greensboro, and then in 85, they did the split with Greensboro and Atlanta. 87 was where they took it to Chicago. And then this year, it was kind of taking it away from a big metropolis like Chicago, didn't go to its home venue of Greensboro, and instead we went to The Scope in Norfolk, Virginia, the home of one Nate Milton, to, I guess, varying levels of success. I mean, they did do 10,000 people here. The gate was about 150,000, which was significantly down from the Greensboro days, and this did about 140,000 buys on pay-per-view. So We had a decent show, but this was hardly a home run business wise for the company.
Yeah, and
was really down in 88.
Yeah, and they did this to avoid Survivor Series as well.
Yeah, this was also the first year they did it as a December show. This was Christmas, the day after Christmas on Boxing Day, and avoided the Survivor Series conflict, which totally fucked them the year before when Survivor Series got thrown on pay-per-view to combat Starrcade and ended up with like 5 cable carriers picking up Starrcade and was accelerated the decline in 88 for the NWA.
Yeah, and I feel like this is another example where we would all like it for like the best actual in-ring wrestling and the best. And these are all great storylines too to really kick out the business. But it just seems like even back then, it's just like sometimes people just don't connect. Like, and the weird thing is like this is like, would you say this is like the prime of Ric Flair's career almost, like as a character, I suppose?
He was going into 89, which was one of his best. I mean, certainly you had that in the 70s, like even after the plane crash where he had outstanding matches. But I mean, he was running hard throughout the 80s, and 89 was one of his best years ever. So in ring, he was, I mean, this is just shy of his 40th birthday, which is insanity.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's, and that's the thing where it's like, I feel like this, when you watch the final match, like, it's kind of weird to see, and it's kind of a weird left turn, but it's like Triple H honestly sees himself as Ric Flair and not Lex Luger in that match. Does that make any sense? Where it's like, because Flair and Triple H, I guess Triple H's period where everyone was sick of him was like 2003 to 2000 now or whatever. But like 2017, but
there were certainly the phases that you can see with Hunter where he went through the Flair phase, when he went through the Harley Race phase.
Yeah. And then he combined all the white boots Triple H that year. That was
sure.
a great year.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I think peak Hunter aggravation was 2003 because Raw was just built around him. I mean, he was just the stalwart champion, and it came at the same time that Goldberg came on a platter. I mean, there were so many options, and it was just
No.
I mean, Raw was a really flat show to me in 2003.
Yeah. You gotta take that pedigree, Goldberg. Who cares? You're not gonna be around here, you know? I just mean, like, can you imagine someone compiling, I'm sure they exist, but actually compiling with a lot of hits a Triple H interview montage or, like, Triple H's best moments? No. And I feel like he just, like, kind of forced himself to be Flair. And the only reason I bring this up is because, I mean, I was 4 at this time, so I don't really know.
In 2003?
In 2003. I'm a 1999 baby. I look terrible. I look absolutely terrible. But I was 4 when this happened, but I understand that people were, like, really sick of Ric Flair. And it just shows, like, what a great performer this dude was. I think people, and as much as it sounds weird, people don't appreciate how good this guy was. Like when you watch, especially when you watch a whole show like Starrcade 88, you really watch how good Ric Flair was relative to his time. Cause it's easy to watch like a Ric Flair match and then a, like Samoa Joe, Chris Daniels, AJ Styles and think like, oh, well, Ric Flair wasn't that good. But you just watch him in the parlance of the time, you know? You gotta have that framing of him.
Of course. And by the end of 88, I mean, a lot of things had happened. Like his heel run, it was like there were so many people that I think just wanted a shift in the character. And also with the Horsemen, this is fresh after Arn and Tully had left for the WWF. So the Horsemen was down to pretty much Flair and Wyndham with J.J. Dillon. And it was just, I mean, 89 when you had Flair more of the babyface role for, I mean, you did have the Steamboat program with Steamboat coming back, but then you also had Terry Funk coming in. Just gave him some fresh opponents as well. Like 88 by the end of this, I mean, it was really just stalling out this Luger program, which, did you know what the original plan was for this Starrcade main event?
Was this not the Rick Steiner wins the title in 3 minutes?
This was the epitome of Dusty needs to go mode, because Dusty and Flair pretty well hated one another at this point, and Dusty wanted this title off of Flair by any means necessary. And he wanted to book Flair and Rick Steiner to go 6 minutes in a cage match to headline this show. And it was Dusty that was pushing hard for this, and it was suddenly, okay, let's pull the reins back here on this Dusty idea. And they overran they outruled him, and then Luger was placed in because that was the Great American Bash match, and they decided, let's give Flair the win in this match over Luger and go with the hotter match, which was Luger at the time. The idea and the thinking was, we put him in there with Rick Steiner, and if Flair doesn't go with it, Rick Steiner will shoot with this guy, which was nuts.
That's so funny.
In 1988, this was still the thinking, and Rick Steiner would come out of this as your champion. Especially, so that's how low Dusty wanted Ric Flair at this moment to end 88.
I don't know how many listeners out there have watched the show, but Rick Steiner is legitimately playing, let's say, a hybrid between Kurt Angle and Eugene?
Yes. A character that today, I don't know how well accepted this character would be in this portrayal.
I actually thought that the way they handled that Rick Steiner character was so much classier than the way they handled Eugene.
No question. No question.
Eugene was like a rejected ECW idea where Polly was like, now that's too tasteless. Now, pardon me, we have to go cut Francine. You know what I mean? It's just terrifying.
Yeah. The Eugene character certainly does not work well in highlight form today. And if anyone ever wanted to put out a really troubling piece on the WWE, Eugene clips would be all you would need to support your thesis.
How did Linda McMahon is part of, is she like part of the cabinet of the presidency in the United States? Like, how did her opponent, anyone she faced, not just show clips of you don't even have to do more than 1 year. You can just do 2003 or 2004. You can just go the whole year. Fine, you're gonna get hot lesbian. Like when a man passed away recently, Rosie. Yeah, Rosie. And I was watching, like, I watched this highlight reel where it was like him and Hurricane, where I was like, oh man, that really sucks. I remember, I have so many fond memories of that guy. But then they showed, and then for some reason on the highlight reel was like the HLA angle where they beat up the people, the HLA girls. I'm like, don't show that as a man, as a memorial for this guy. Like him beating up local strippers. Like, that's not good. That's not what's hot.
Yeah, I mean, they were, yeah, there was that angle with them. It was one where they laid out Moolin Mae Young as well. That was kind of their introduction that most people probably associate with 3 Minute Warning. But let us get into this show, the grand Starrcade event.
Luger, I want you to shut this mouth, pal. Starrcade! Woo! The Nature War! And the Total Package! Ha ha! Woo! Bam Bam Bigelow, when you step in the ring for a championship match, to where we go, guns out, from the very start, you're not going to walk from that ring victorious.
You should have made it a point to get both of them, Daddy. Don't just get one. Don't take one limb. Don't take one heart. Don't take one ear. And don't take one eye. If Sting has to carry me on his back down that aisle, if he has to drag me in a wagon, I'm breathing. You understand what I'm saying? You should have got it done. It's violence for the sake of violence. And now I will turn it around to my violence, my lightning bolt, my fire, my thunder. An eye for an eye.
We had graphics with sound bites from all the various wrestlers cutting promos with Flair, Wyndham, Dusty, who was vying. An eye for an eye. He was going after the vision of Animal and Hawk.
I really like the idea of an eye match, where it's just like the loser gets stabbed in the eyes.
Loser
no
loses
gimmicks
their
needed.
Eye.
This is Southern wrestling. Oh. We get knives. We'll throw you into the crowd.
Probably would have been his thought when business was down. Our announcers are Jim Ross and Bob Caudle. And then, of course, we had our hosts for the event, Tony Schiavone and Magnum TA, which was typical of a WCW-NWA production at this time to have the two sets, our hosts and our announcers.
I really like this because I watched this originally around the time of WrestleMania. And then you watch this where it's like Magnum TA and Tony Schiavone are talking about this is a gala evening and they're in tuxedos. And then you watch WrestleMania where it's like where Jerry the King Lawler was hosting and he was just in his sparkliest t-shirt. It's just like throw a suit on, King. Like,
WrestleMania t-shirt. Come on.
You gotta have a WrestleMania t-shirt on. I really like how like it's Starrcade. Everyone has to wear tuxedos. Are we carnies? Of course we're carnies, but it doesn't matter. We're all in tuxedos, you know?
Something I loved on this show was just some of the signs that the crowd had here.
So
we had ones like, Ric Flair is the complete champion. Luger is the total wimp. Lex, tonight is your night to shine with numerical necessity here for this sign.
You got to do it. You got to – there's only so much room. That's something I would have done when I was a kid was like I'll write this sign and then oh no, I really made the letters too big. And now I got to make twos for everything.
80 signs. I mean there's just the two extremes. You either get campy signs like I just read or you get – like that famous sign that you've seen, Roddy Piper has AIDS.
Yeah.
Like in this giant banner with red block letters, just in case Piper misses it. He so wants good. To be informed.
And you could also see the difference between the crowd in a WWF show where it's like kids having fun. And every crowd shot in this is like would be a man with a mustache and a trucker hat so angry. And then sometimes when the heel would cheat, you would just see this one guy stand up and just flip double bird without saying anything and then sit right back down. It was like, this is my calling card. Like, they're going to see this. The referee's going to see this and be like, well, Craig's pissed off, so we better reverse the decision.
One other thing with these Starrcades that I go back, you know, I didn't grow up where it was like the Thanksgiving tradition and us being Canadians wouldn't have really got the same effect even for the early Starrcades. But the post Christmas big wrestling show is something I really miss. That WCW, you always had that big card right after Christmas. And the UFC's kind of inherited that now where they do their year-end show. It's kind of the final Saturday of the year. But that's kind of gone by the wayside now where a Starrcade event, you don't have that big Christmas show any longer where here these fans in Norfolk, they open their Christmas presents and Boxing Day, it's off to the scope.
It seems great. It seems great to, open your presents and just go down and watch. I mean, I don't know how much I would want my kids around this crowd, though. It's like, oh, kids, come on. We're going to go hear a man say homophobic things to everyone.
Different time.
Different time. Yeah, one of my there was a friend who went to a show. I think it was like Rocky Johnson in Northern Ontario.
Oh, dear.
And, you can tell this one's going bad immediately. Rocky Johnson picked up the microphone, pointed at his opponent, and it's like, when I say chant, you guys chant gay at him. And there was all these children just chanting gay, gay, gay at this, like, at this wrestler. So that's what you're running into if you're going to 80s wrestling.
Well, that was a bit of a swerve given that you set it up with Rocky Johnson and tasteless chants. So we got the homophobic chant instead of a racist one.
Hey, I'll clean it up. You know what I mean? You got to do what you got
to
do.
So we kick things off with the United States Tag Team Championships as the Fantastics, who had just won the vacant titles in a tournament, defeating Eddie Gilbert and Ron Simmons in this like half hour Clash of the Champions match. Imagine Ron Simmons in a 30-minute tag match.
It was perfect. And the other, and Eddie Gilbert's character during this time was, see, I'm friends with Ron Simmons. I'm not a racist. Every promo was him being like, as you could see, I'm friends with Ron Simmons, meaning not a racist guy. And everyone was like, what? Yeah, just tell us who you're going to beat the other guys. Like, we don't care.
And his sunglasses, of course.
And his indoors. Beautiful, beautiful sunglasses.
They were taking on Varsity Club members Dr. Death, Steve Williams, who had just joined the group, and Kevin Sullivan. With, of course, this was after the angle, which we'll discuss later, where they had kicked out Rick Steiner.
Yes.
And I guess by connection, Alex as well. I guess he had an honorary membership in the Varsity Club.
Yes,
the imaginary Alex. Gary Michael Capetta was our ring announcer. Sullivan billed from Singapore. And our referee for this match, of all the involvement in this match, the
beautiful
one WWE Hall of Famer was the referee, Teddy Long.
Teddy Long, who had, what would you say this hairstyle is? Like,
1988.
It was 1988.
How I classified
it's
as.
Just, yeah, it's just like the wettest hair, the wettest hair I've ever seen in my life.
And maybe the most improbable future Scott Putski Award winner, because once we got into early 90s, Teddy Long,
the man,
did his chin-ups.
The man started working out.
Long days in the gym for Teddy. So anyway, did you notice this, that the hard camera was clearly not balanced? Like, typically when you put like a camera on a tripod, you have like a bubble that you just line it up for so that you have a balanced shot. Not in Jim Crockett Promotions. This was not a good sign for the new Turner executives.
I love the JCP. Well, that man, I'm assuming that cameraman was also smoking a cigarette. And they're like,
possible.
Well, why would he balance it? He's smoking, you know?
Yes. We also had a shot of Jason Hervey and his friend, as Jim Ross identified her as. This would have been, I looked up, I believe Jason Hervey would have been 14 years old around this time.
That's
doing
so
the Wonder
good.
Years.
That's so good.
And Jason he was Hervey like just the super fan at these NWA events, and was the NWA just did cartwheels that Jason Hervey was here at their shows.
It's absolutely a gala evening. How would you not know Jason Hervey is there?
Like, just the weirdest, like, 6 degrees of wrestling that Jason Hervey has remained semi-attached to the industry for as long as he has through Eric Bischoff.
Wrestling has always been, like, this weird mismatch of, like, which celebrities will come out? Please, someone. Like, early UFCs would be like, Kevin James is in the crowd again. Or, like, one... I remember one UFC, I really forget which was, and I really want to know, and I've actually tried to watch back and confirm which one it was, but David Spade clearly has brought in his own alcohol.
Oh, dude, David Spade drunk at UFC events seems like that's how I mostly picture him, even though it probably only happened once.
But it was like David Spade is here, and he's pouring a Mickey into a Coke he brought in. So not only did he bring in the Mickey, he also brought in the Coke. So clearly some security guard was like, yeah, sure, David Spade, you can bring in your little bottle of Coke.
Just let us frame you up here.
Yeah, exactly.
We want to have a balanced shot here for the audience at home.
I'm finished my cigarette.
Dr. Death did these repeated military presses to Bobby Fulton. Of course, Bobby Fulton and the late Tommy Rogers comprising the Fantastics. And Williams runs his knee into the back of Rogers in the corner. There was a long sustained heat spot on Rogers. They just beat him up. Finally, he rolls forward, tagging in Fulton. Williams has a bear hug applied and then a thumb to the eye as Fulton escapes. Rogers comes off the top, lands on the feet of Sullivan. They get the advantage on Rogers, and then the crowd just goes nuts for the 10 punches on the turnbuckle spot. I mean, this crowd, they were just growing and growing in volume with each successive punch by Bobby Fulton to Dr. Death. Fulton then applied a sleeper to Williams. Rogers then applied a sleeper to Sullivan. And Fulton utilized a Thez press, gets guillotined on the top rope with Williams pinning him in 15:51, even though Bobby Fulton, ever the veteran, kicks out at 2.5 just to save his heat as the heels get the win and are now your new U.S. Tag Team Champions.
I really, really enjoyed this match. I really enjoyed Kevin Sullivan, who Bob Caudle said, this guy's an athlete. He's a four-sport high school athlete, which is so – like, I'm a two-sport high school athlete, and I can't move side to side anymore.
Wow. What sports did you play?
I played football and basketball, reserves in both.
Nice. Where did you go to school? Did you grow up in Toronto?
No, I grew up in Stouffville.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I went to a summer camp once in Stouffville.
How was it?
It was on a farm.
It was very – yeah. I think we used to drive by that farm. We're like, man, those kids paid too much for that summer camp.
It was not that great.
It was like, what did you do on it? Did you like play baseball and then they were like, go do some yard work?
It was all just – yeah. It was all outdoor activities every single day where you got to swim. You got to do capture the flag. You just got to do all this shit outside. And then if it rained, you just went indoors to like this warehouse for the entire day. Yeah. I was like, this is stupid. I never wanted to go to summer camp. I did not enjoy it. And it was
I feel like parents with summer camp are just like, go here. And they're like, oh, what type of summer camp is it? It's not at home. Just don't be home, please.
It's vacation time for your parents. When I was like an 8-9-year-old, I had the paranoia at the summer camp that I was going to get on the wrong bus to go home. That was my biggest fear that summer, was that I'm going to get on the wrong bus and be lost forever.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then there was one day where they always had them like by numerical order, and it rained one day, so we were in our warehouse all day, and they mixed up the order of the buses, and it messed with my entire system.
So in this warehouse, they didn't even show you like Mighty Ducks 2 or anything? They were
I can't give you
stare at that wall, John.
I can't give you a good memory. Maybe they popped in a 4-year-old tape of Starrcade 88 True Grit.
That would be amazing. That was back in when – this is going to sound – like how old you're going to sound describing what Blockbuster is to like – like if we
– oh, there's people now that would have zero clue. Like we are at that era now where there is a generation that will give you a blank stare on what Blockbuster is when you talk about it.
Yeah.
Like imagine in 20 years explaining to a child of yours the process of going to rent a video. Like actually getting into a car, going to a building where you have to select a tape and have a card and you have a return date.
Yeah.
And think how crazy that sounds to a child in 20 years.
And to buy that tape, if you are a week late, it's $50 extra.
Yeah. And think of explaining this crime you committed by renting said tape and dubbing it at your house, which all of us did.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to incriminate you, Dylan, but I will fully admit that I did this plenty of times with my Rogers tapes.
I taped The Last Nitro and tried to sell it. When I was
I'm going to sell this free show.
I remember going to school and be like, I have the last WCW Nitro, which as we all know is going to be a huge collector's item. Not only that, but I have the Patriot that I taped off of City TV. I taped the Patriot and it still has commercials. I watched it because
the commercial is the biggest kicker for me is that so many things I taped that I cut the commercials out. I would pause it and not include the commercials, and I kick myself today because that would be the highlight. I can get the event now anywhere. It's like all these tapes of wrestling I taped when I was a kid are pretty much on a streaming service now.
Yeah.
But the commercials, that's just lost to time.
Or you see like this might be a shock. Jim Van Horn sports updates, or like if you would tape like a movie on the week on, this is getting now very, very regional, but on like Fox 29 for our Buffalo and Toronto, you would see
WUTV.
That and
then
they would and they would just play the Hardy Boys theme song.
That's right, because them and the Hardcore Holly had like these domain or these rights free themes that could just be utilized on anything.
Yeah, it was just production music, and same with WCW Chris Benoit and
Chris Jericho,
Jericho as well,
Pearl Jam ripoff.
Yeah. Even the like, there's that story that wasn't. Isn't there a story that the old NWO theme is like in a porno somewhere because it's just like production house music?
It's porn music, so. Wouldn't surprise me at all that it's incorporated.
It's the only
somewhere.
It's also one of the great wrestling themes because it's the only theme that ends. Like every other I listen to wrestling themes on my iPod because like you gotta get pumped up for life, right? And it's the only theme that ends. It's like it's got that actual end.
Yeah, the others are like, hey, I've never heard it go this deep on television.
Exactly. And that's one thing you lose on this show is you lose like, and the ECW shows too, it's like Dusty doesn't come out to this wasn't Midnight Rider time, no? Like what was his theme song? I don't even know.
He was coming out at this it escapes me right now, but you're right, all the themes on this, like the Midnight Express coming out to generic music.
Yeah, instead of that wonderful Midnight Express theme song.
I'll say I feel these are preserved better than the ECW shows to me are just massacred, and maybe that's because in my head the music was such a big part of the entrances, whereas
New Jack matches, you can't watch a New Jack match on the network.
Oh, it's brutal. Yeah, they're brutal.
And New Jack was that company for a year. Like, and people don't really believe it, but like, New Jack, that guy, I should do a cheap plug in the middle, I guess. But
go for it.
I have a podcast called The Wrestler Review, and we reviewed New Jack's career. And I was just kind of talking about like how this guy was one of the great promos that really never got his due.
Outstanding promo.
Amazing. It was an amazing promo. And other than his promos, his match style was like what you would say now is like a YouTube video. They play music and it's just pure violence. There's nothing else. He had great gimmicks with his like belt shots and stuff. Or sorry, weapon shots. And it was fantastic. But now if you're a wrestling fan and you're 18 just getting into it and you see who is this New Jack guy, and then you hear like exactly like some production assistant who's 21 just had to do his music and do all of New Jack's matches in a day, I assume is what happened. And then they just had to pick up some song and kind of ruined it.
This might have been his Hank Williams Jr. phase.
Oh, man.
You can't judge a book by the cover.
That's perfect.
This was post-Bob Seger. Just imagine a baby face, the top baby face in your territory coming out to old time rock and roll. That's balls on Dusty's part. Shivani and Magnum TA then preview the rest of the card. And up next was your main event, the original Midnights. Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose against Bobby Eaton and Stan Lane.
Perfect. Dennis Condrey wearing just a fat guy with a bib. Just my uncle when he's having one too many ribs at a barbecue where it's like, I got to take my shirt off, but I don't want to get my face can't
with the,
have
the, like the bandana tied around the neck.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
Southern gentleman style.
Oh, man.
Dennis Condrey.
And is there a better name in wrestling history than Randy Rose? It's just like.
Is there a better hair cut than Randy Rose
so
in
good.
1988?
And one thing that wrestling's kind of lost, this match has a lot, which is managers, like the managers are also very much
they were the stars of the program.
So
with
good.
All due respect to the other four.
Yeah, exactly. So good. But that's what these guys need because, like, I mean, Condrey has some natural charisma because, like, you just want to look at that bib, essentially. That's some natural charisma right there. But they don't have to do anything. You've taken away one of the most complex things about being a pro wrestler, which is, like, the interviews. Those are done now. You don't have to worry about it. You get – and I didn't really think I would end up hating Heyman. But I was like, I actually watched this, and being a Paul Heyman fan, hated him the whole time. He's absolutely a great performer. How long is he into the business at this time?
Oh, he's short because this was obviously after Memphis, and he had only been in, I want to say, 3 years tops.
That's insane.
And the way this came about, and I definitely recommend Jim Cornette's. He did a whole Midnight Express history book a number of years back. Yeah, it's a phenomenal resource that I went through before doing this show and was talking about the fact this program came about because the Midnights had kind of gone through all of these tag teams and they saw that Condrey and Rose were starting to work together and they just called up dangerously and said, hey, you guys want to come in and work with us? And they pitched it to the booking team at the time, to Dusty. They went with it and that's how it came about. And it was Dangerously's big break getting into a major territory here to come in and do the natural feud involving both Midnight Express teams. And on top of that, this was coming at the end of 88. And the way they had these contracts structured were that they weren't paying guys like on this every 2 week kind of schedule or anything. It was sometimes you'd be given a bunch of your money here, maybe short here, but at the end of the year, they'd make up whatever big difference there was, and it got called these balloon payments. And they were behind on all these different guys' pay, including the Midnight Express, who ended up getting like a fraction of what they were owed. And one of the cost-cutting measures they did was for all the house shows, they took Cornette and Dangerously off the road, which were a huge aspect to this feud was having the managers at ringside. So they had them here, obviously, for the pay-per-view. But then the post-Christmas house shows, Dangerously and Cornette were being paid to sit at home and not getting their whatever it was, couple of $100,000 payoffs for the house shows.
Yeah.
So it was a weird time here for the NWA and what they were paying guys. So Cornette comes out, challenges Dangerously at the start. And Cornette gets on the mic saying he's going to kick that punk's butt. And I say this with tongue planted firmly in cheek, but my God, was there a ton of heat for Dangerously and Cornette here.
And they play so well off each other. And Cornette's given a bunch of interviews saying they are friends and stuff, and it really shines through here. Just like, I really love the manager versus manager angle. They did a really good one with, I mean, it was towards the end of, like when Bobby Heenan got, he was in ROH at the time, so he was going through some treatments for his cancer or whatever, but they did a really, really good one where it was Bobby Heenan, I think it was Bobby Heenan, Colt Cabana versus Jim Cornette, and I want to say Jimmy Rave. And they did this really good, like, who could out-cheat the other one? And they do the exact same thing here. And I also think it's really – because the Midnight Express also, the new Midnight Express, have just kind of turned babyface because they just had a feud with the Road Warriors. And I really like it when guys keep that aspect of their character. Like, they're still cheating. Cornette's still helping them cheat in this match. You know, they haven't ditched that completely.
Yeah. So Lane and Eaton cleared the ring after the bell rung to start the match, and Cornette uses his racket as dangerously rings the bell, and he wants a disqualification called.
Perfect.
But the match continues. Ross singles out Bill Apter at ringside, calling him the Bob Newhart of wrestling photography.
Jim Ross. I really like Jim Ross because you see the two types of styles of commentary on this, which is Jim Ross is like, isn't it great to be at a wrestling show? And Bob Caudle's like, I'm just done with this. Like, I'm done.
Well, like, Jim, I don't know what we're going to expect here. I'll tell you, Bob.
Exactly. Just screaming. And Bob Caudle's like, I frankly just want my wife here. I'm worried about her.
Cornette nails Randy Rhodes with the racket to the back and dangerously starts throwing a tantrum. And Ross believes that Eaton and Lane are the better version of the Midnights than Eaton and Condrey ever were.
Oh, man. Well, but those kicks, who could you?
Oh, we'll get into the kicks here. Eaton landed a top rope elbow onto Condrey and then hits him with a bulldog, and then Eaton misses in the corner. Lane seated on the middle turnbuckle as the original Midnights get all the heat here. They keep him away from Lane, dangerously takes a cheap shot, and Cornette just chases after dangerously to this gigantic reaction. Like, that was the tease that this audience wanted to see fulfilled with Cornette getting his hands on dangerously, which I'm just imagining these house shows where you take those two out of the equation and how less that match gets over without Cornette and dangerously part of the equation.
Yeah, it just got to be like, it almost has to be second match in where everyone watches away, but like, oh, that was a really well done pro wrestling match that I didn't really care about.
Yeah, Cornette was the biggest babyface in this match, in my opinion. There was a power slam to Condrey. Rose is on top, misses with the rocket launcher, now known as the Boom Shakalaka. Imagine Jim Ross calling that in 1988.
I would love to hear that.
Dangerously is just sweating up a storm here. He's hammering the mat as Lane gets tagged in. Lane hits him with his karate kicks and maybe the most 1988 dance you can possibly imagine, just shaking his hips.
It's so – like, these kicks, if you haven't seen this, you've got to watch it because it's like honky-tonk man level of laying it. And like, I don't even think he hits him with one of the kicks.
Like, Stan Lane may as well have just had his room number on his tights for the women watching this.
Like,
that
like
was what
Tybo
he was conveying here.
Yeah, exactly.
With his sign language, with his hips.
Oh, man.
Long, Teddy Long, who, let's go over the referee situation. We had two referees that split up the matches. We had Teddy Long doing the first half and Tommy Young the second half. And that was our referee contingent.
Can you imagine that mentally? Just remembering all of, like, having, like, okay, you're doing an hour of refereeing?
Seriously. And back to back.
Yeah, just
like,
stay in the
separate
ring, Teddy.
Them. This was intense. By the fourth match in, I was like, Christ, like, Teddy Long has to have lost 10 pounds.
Now, this might be a silly question, but what do you think is harder to referee? Do you think it's MMA or do you think it's pro wrestling?
Depends on the pro wrestling. But if you are doing, say, like a Flair Luger where tons of near falls and pin attempts.
Yes.
Like, you will blow up quick if you are not accustomed to that kind of a match.
Yes.
So it has to depend on the type. I mean, you could also have had like the Bunkhouse Stampede that was the dark match on this show where, hey, it's a night off. So
I love anything Bunkhouse. I mean, this is the names for these things are so much better because, yeah, like I've said this 1,000 times on this so far, but like WWE is so slick. And like everything's so slick the way they've done everything, like the Raw set really hasn't changed since 2002, and this is just so rough, like just Bunkhouse or Tennessee or Texas, throw it in front of something and it's just like, what is it? Oh, he hits him with a cowbell and then he touches the ropes. Oh, what's the Tennessee struggle? Oh, he has a cowbell. It's just something with a cowbell. Go for it.
It was, to me, they looked at it as like this negative that they felt they had such a southern product, but to me it was just such Like, you go back and look at the heat on some of these shows. Yeah. And this one I wouldn't even place near the high end of it. Like, go pull out some big angle from 85 and the way this audience reacted, that, I mean, it was just unbelievable. And to me, it was a charm to this product rather than a hindrance.
Yeah, exactly. There's times where you see wrestlers cheat on this card and people just stand up, point at them and go, fuck you. And then sit back down. It's like, I want to be there.
Couldn't beat this. So anyway, Stan Lane continues here. Long gets distracted as Lane has the cover on Randy Rose, dangerously attacks him. So Cornette, this is his big spot to run in and attack Paul. Long goes for the cover, discovers Paul's phone, and stops counting three. Lane and Eaton hit the double goozle onto Randy Rose and win the match in 1647. The double goozle.
That's so good. This is another one of my favorite little things about the NWA is that they would not ignore just obvious shrapnel around the ring from cheating.
Jeff Jarrett would have died here with the guitar. He wouldn't have been able to get away with it.
Or I think it was there's a New Age Outlaws versus Headbangers match where the Outlaws just smoke mosh with
the
radio.
The big radio.
Yeah, the
boombox.
And literally pin them in the middle of the smashed radio. And
Thrasher's
just
head is split in half.
Yeah, and Lawler's just being like, the thing they use to cheat is right there. He's just screaming it, and it's the referee's like, I'm willing to ignore.
Man, someone just posted a clip the other day on Reddit, and it's Jim Cornette calling a battle royal. And he was like, wait a minute. Funaki just eliminated, I think it was Taka.
Yeah.
So they're the teammates. He's like, Funaki just eliminated Taka. That's bullshit. It's great. So afterwards, Condrey attacks Jim Cornette with the tennis racket and then use the phone on him. And then they attack Stan Lane with a phone to the body. Bobby Eaton makes the big comeback with the racket and the camera. And we zoom in on Cornette as you hear this gigantic pop here for this post-match attack.
And, like, credits to Cornette, because this guy, like, what would we say, like a year earlier, not even, is the hugest heel. He's the mama's boy heel. And then within this, and it really shows how good Heyman is, too, that 3 years into the business, he's got Jim Cornette over as a monster-like face.
Jim Cornette was a very underrated babyface manager because he had that ability where he was so hated that by the time he did the giant switch, it was just the fans love this guy afterwards after hating him for so long.
Yeah, it's one of those classic, like, finally we get to cheer this guy who's so fun to watch.
Yeah, and of course then the Midnight Express would go on to the Jim Herd era, and Jim Cornette would certainly be a part of that for the next year and a half, and it was quite the roller coaster ride.
Yeah, this is really, I don't know if you want to, like you said, business was down here, but like you could say artistically speaking, this is a high point for, it's great. It just is wrestling in so many ways.
Ross and Caudle put the match over, and Ross makes it clear that the feud will continue, which it would for a little bit before they were going to do like a loser of the fall leaves, and they were planning to book it so Randy Rose would be gone. Dennis Condrey thought this sucked, so he no-showed, and he ended up just disappearing. And within 2 months, by that time, Dennis Condrey was gone, and this feud kind of fizzled.
That's what I love about the 80s wrestling, though. It's like, you want me to lose? Not showing up. Just, nope, I'm gone.
Yep.
It's great. Just doesn't happen anymore. The huge thing that happened, I know he's like a huge star, but when CM Punk no-showed, people were like, but he has to show up. He has a contract. If it was the 80s, CM Punk would be king. He'd just be no-showing all over the place. He'd be like, yeah, he'd just be in the AWA champion for 2 weeks and then show up in the Fed and show up in NWA. Would have been great.
Yeah, but really this feud, it was the door opening for Paulie to get into WCW. And he was the one, I mean, he got paired with the Samoan SWAT team after the Express and then had his run there in the NWA. So, I mean, this thing worked out pretty well for him out of all three of them.
Yeah,
then just
getting out the door with Dennis Condrey and old Randy Rose.
Magnum TA is with the Varsity Club in the locker room with Williams and Sullivan holding their U.S. tag titles. As Williams says, suspensions and probations don't matter, which is nice. Sullivan says they traded a moron, in reference to Rick Steiner, for a genius in Dr. Death Steve Williams, which, given his decision to try and get pot into Japan, I don't know if genius is the label.
Yes.
But hey, he did have a benefactor in Giant Baba, so maybe at the end of the day, he did come ahead. States that they're going to run Rick Steiner out of this business, and Rotunda is going to beat him, quote, like a stupid dog. You know how you kick them? And he motions as though he's kicking an animal.
Mike Rotunda was so good here. And Mike Rotunda also one of the undercover benefactors of the Jim Herd era. Because I don't know if you know this story, but have you heard of Captain Mike Rotunda?
Of course.
Captain Mike Rotunda, and he said his explanation on Captain Mike Rotunda was like, yeah, I mean, they told me they'd give me a boat, so I was like, yeah, I'll take it. And he just, like, apparently got a boat for doing this angle. He was like, we know the character's stupid, but we'll give you a boat. And he's like, hell yeah. I'm a captain of a ship or whatever the hell you want me to be. Rotunda was great here, too. He's such a dick. Like, he looks great.
It's great to go to a show like this, and maybe we'll do this in the near future, where you go and look at an event maybe a year and a half from this, and characters under the Jim Herd era, like Mike Rotunda, perfect example of where he goes here, yeah, under Dusty versus 1990 by that point where he is.
Yeah, and it's easy to be like, oh, Dusty had some really stupid ideas, but he still was like, Mike Rotunda, his name is Mike Rotunda. He's not, a ship captain. He doesn't have a computer that tells him how to win matches.
So we had the Russians, David Sheldon and Jack Victory.
Jack Victory? I did not know how far back this man went in wrestling.
Far. Like, way further than you would have expected.
He's just there.
If you just were introduced to this guy in ECW, you would have no idea his tenure prior to 98-99 ECW. But yeah, here he is teaming with David Sheldon under a mask against the Junkyard Dog, who had just been brought in. And with all due respect, the Junkyard Dog, who never an in-ring marvel, he was, can I say, useless at this time in 1988?
He's almost too tired to bark.
Teaming with Ivan Koloff, who, recently passed away. And by 1988, I mean, this was right around the time where they were kind of going to cease ties with Ivan Koloff, who, I mean,
but still in better shape than Junkyard Dog somehow.
Yes. This guy had beaten Bruno in 71.
Yeah.
So put that into context. This is 17 years later.
And he's one of those people, old school wrestlers have this, where it's like, is that man older than all these people? Yes. Am I intimidated of him for a reason I can't put my finger on? Of course. Like, comes through the screen. And this is the classic NWA thing where it's like, yeah, this Russian guy likes America now, so cheer for him. And then later on they'll be like, he's actually not from Russia.
Yeah, and you go back a few years when he was paired with the other Russians. I mean, still a great promo. Still a great heel. But at this point, he was a babyface, and I guess his time was winding down here. Teddy Long checks the masks of the Russians, and they note that if the Russians lose by pinfall, they must unmask and their manager, Paul Jones, must retire. So very one-sided stipulation.
A Junkyard Dog, if you lose, that's fine.
That will be a loss on your official record.
That's so funny.
JYD gets on all fours delivering headbutts to the Russian number one as he sends him into the corner turnbuckle, and Ross notes JYD's legendary status in Louisiana, completely eliminating that little run he had with those other guys out of New York.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Who cares? This is he used to be able to move really well, then nothing happened for a couple of years, and now he's extremely tired all the time.
Yes. This also brought one of our many stereotypes of the 80s, this being the hard-headed African-American.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, wrestling.
That's
that
not a fun time.
You kind of have to shield your eyes, and
I just pretend it's not happening. It's like sometimes the best way I can describe I watch wrestling from the 80s is like my parents are having sex in the other room. I just try and pretend it's not happening. You know, some of the racism or whatever else is happening.
Koloff hit an assisted chokeslam that Russian number two basically gave himself by jumping.
Yes.
So Jack Victory,
he's working overtime,
compensating here,
here
for Ivan Koloff. Koloff then clotheslined him off the second turnbuckle. Number one breaks the cover, and then Koloff uses a sunset flip, and this distracts Teddy Long. They explain why JYD's head is the hardest.
Jesus Christ. They're just going
to context.
It's like a slippery slope to eugenics. It's awful.
Number one then misses an axe handle coming off the top, hits number two with JYD moving. Ross then states how sorry, this is great. Number two misses in the corner. So Bob Caudle, This is 1988, okay?
Yeah, this is Bob Caudle, though.
Stating how that missile was a dud, trying to tie it into world politics at the time.
Yeah.
And Ross says, there are no peace talks here.
Oh, my God. Jim Ross, that's Jim Ross. This is classic. Like, if you ever do improv, the tenet is yes and. Jim Ross was like, Caudle, you think it's 1973? Let's go with it.
This is right after George H.W. Bush's won the election. So yeah. we were trying to keep things topical in December 88. Koloff hits him with JYD with the Russian sickle, and then number two gets an object placed into his mask, hitting Koloff with it, and then we get twin magic with the Russian switch, and they get the fall. 6:46 after Paul Jones had placed the object into Russian number one's mask.
Yeah, my
diabolical.
Reaction, my reaction to this match was, oh, that's over quickly. That's probably for the best.
6:46. That was as long as it needed to be.
I really, really – like, can you imagine if Kalisto goes heel and then he's always putting stuff in his mask? Like, when's the last time they did the headbutt with something in your mask angle?
It's been some time.
It's been – I feel like they should bring it back. I mean, I feel like if that was Kalisto's thing, he's like, well, check his mask. And then he's always cheating.
I want
great. I mean, he'd be over as a baby face because it's 2017. But.
I don't want anyone to try this, but I want you to imagine if you were wearing a lucha mask and you put a hard object in between the mask and your
yes.
forehead and drilled it into another human, how much reciprocal damage that would do to yourself.
Well, I mean, the Russians, their heads are harder.
But not the hardest, because that was outlined to us.
That was.
If JYD was a Russian.
This is really like, this is a forerunner to the Shibata match that just happened, right? Shibata Okada. This is just a battle of the headbutts, and who wins?
You know, they could have called it the nuclear warheads.
Oh my God, that would have been. John?
The Moabs.
We need a time machine, because you could take over for Dusty.
Bob Caudle says, we've seen three great matches, which. Bit of an overstatement coming off our last one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Bob Caudle just seems like
I enjoy Bob Caudle.
He
was your grandfather watching wrestling,
exactly.
Which I think is an underrated role that's totally gone today.
The thing I really like about like wrestling like this is there's so many silly, fun things to sink your teeth into where it's like this is the type of wrestling you could watch and someone would come in. And be like, oh, this is silly, but I can watch it. Instead of, you know, later era where it's like, the sluts, ladies and gentlemen, the tag team of the sluts, you know? Just not, it's there's a really great Instagram thing where it's just, it was like Happy International Women's Day. And it just showed hot lesbian action. But it was just the tag of the girls coming down the ring. It just said the lesbians.
The lesbians.
It's absolutely perfect.
Next up, television title time, Mike Rotunda, pre-Captain Mike, taking on Rick Steiner. So he was going to come – by hook or by crook, he was coming out of this show with a title, Dylan.
He needs a belt. I really like this Rick Steiner character, and it's – like as this match moves on, some really cool stuff, like some stylized chances stuff. I think Rick Steiner was absolutely fantastic and had a crazy look at this time.
Yeah. I mean, this was a match that it was up until the end where they weren't totally into it, but then it was a 180 where this crowd, when they realized the title change was coming and when it happened, this place lost their mind.
It was crazy because it's also the only title loss I've seen where – I guess it would be like if Ty Dillinger won the title, people just scream 10. And it's the exact same thing. People just start barking. And you really forget how – it sounds weird, but before I started doing my silly podcast, I didn't really realize how long a singles career Rick Steiner had before he was in the
Steiners. This was like – he was 5 years in by this point.
Yeah, exactly.
And not paired with his brother who had just started and I think was in Continental at this time and a few months later would come in. But that's only when the team started. I mean, a lot of people just assume they were attached at the hip from the get-go, but they had their own careers.
Yeah, and he's like absolutely – he's like – he's better on a promo than I thought he would be. I mean, the character, like you said – not exactly 2017 appropriate, but he's great on promo.
So Kevin Sullivan is hung above the ring inside of a cage in this match.
And seems – he's another guy. He's in the cage and he's not like – you see some manager in the cage like, oh, let me at him. Kevin Sullivan's pretty pumped that he's in this cage. He's like, I don't have to do anything. This is great.
They had a big flurry at the start and Steiner's getting the better of Rotunda. He hits a shoulder tackle, sending Rotunda to the floor, which Ross describes Rotunda limp as a dish rag.
I mean, Jim Ross is just all over the place with these great, because he has to do basically 75% of the commentary, because like you said, like Bob Caudill is just your nice grandpa. So he just says these things. Bob Caudill will be like, yeah, sure, Jim.
What is your era of preference? Like, I assume you were a Jim Ross fan, and because
yes.
NWA, WCW Jim Ross, very different from late 90s, early 2000s Jim Ross. I think that like his delivery very different, and the way in which he called a match. Did you have a preference?
I actually liked 92 WCW Jim Ross, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But just because it's a new thing I get to discover. But I mean, probably always Attitude Era Jim Ross, because that's like when I was watching wrestling, like at the height of me watching wrestling, right? Like, mm-hmm. like every week on the internet, like had a username, just pathetic man. I was.
What was your username? Oh boy.
Do you want to know?
Let me guess. Stan Lane's Hips 05.
Oh, it's so much worse. What was yours first? I got to get the incriminating evidence first, because this one's bad.
You know what? I really didn't use a whole lot of like screen names for anything. We usually went with like a – I don't know why, but I think when I signed up for Yahoo to play like poker games and stuff, I just had Johnny01A, and I carried that through everywhere.
You smart man.
I think because at the age of 15, I was like, what will be a name that will not haunt me?
That is so – mine was Big Dog, D-A-W-G.
That's the only way you could spell it in 1999. 666. Oh, my God. The dog from hell.
I was Cerberus back then.
Man.
People were scared. I had the Patriot on VHS. People always making big moves back then.
Man, look at that. Did anyone ever buy that Nitro from you?
Pardon? No, it's still like a lot of stuff I taped off television just in – I think I have most of the ECW on TNNs. With Spike TV, I guess. Oh my God.
Are those all up on the network now? All the TNN ones?
I'm not sure.
Because I haven't checked recently. What they have put up recently, I think it's every episode of Mid-South from 1982 is now up. Like they used to have like 7 episodes, and now it's an entire year's worth, and then some scattered episodes. But you have, I think it's 82 from start to finish. The weekly TV is now up on the network, which is incredible.
It is. And they also have, you want to take a big bite out of Smoky Mountain Wrestling? Then
yeah.
You can do that. The Dirty White Boy?
All over it.
Oh, my God.
Some Jim Ross in there.
There is some Jim Ross in there. And they would also do that fun thing where it would be like, Randy Savage is going to do a promo. And it would just be like Randy Savage talking about something. And then it's like, well, he technically was on TV, wasn't he? Keep watching.
Some Gigolo Jimmy Del Rey.
Gigolo Jimmy. Well Done was on there. Well Done, who I basically the same gimmick as the Fantastics. But I don't know if anyone has watched a Well Done match recently, but they had like tights. So they had like a singlet. But they had a thong painted on their singlet?
Of course.
So, like, they're good. It was like they're bad guys because they're male strippers, which the Fantastics here were their bad guys. They were, I'm assuming, bad guys at some point because they were male strippers. But then they started liking America, so now they're cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Back to Mike Rotunda, Rick Steiner. Limp as a dish rag, Mike Rotunda. Steiner applied a hammerlock and then appeared to bite him in the ass.
Yes.
So the dog-faced gremlin in full effect in 1988.
His gimmick is that he is a man who believes he's a dog.
Yeah, he's physically a dog.
He's a man.
Which
but,
brings up all kinds of questions of what species Alex is, his imaginary friend at the time that he would talk to and do like hand puppets with.
They had some very weird Rick Steiner storylines. This was also pre him, his super fan, how they introduced
yep.
woman,
yep.
where it's Rick Steiner has sex with woman. And then she turns into an insatiable sexual beast who then gets two gimps as their man. Like, they went down some really sticky.
Also, extra credit, and we'll get to this later, was Magnum TA, who would no-sell the shit out of Rick Steiner's imaginary friend and all his bullshit. Like, he had no interest in putting this over as any kind of semblance of reality.
You got to feel bad for Magnum on this show, because you can really feel he's like, I want to be out there, but he, you know, it really stinks. But as a backstage interviewer, I thought he was great, because he's like, okay, let's keep this going, buddy.
Afterwards, Rotunda's taking a walk on the floor, complains about the fans bothering him, and Ross says that it isn't hard to confuse Rick Steiner.
Yeah, I mean, his whole gimmick is that he's mentally handicapped, and that's funny.
Capetta signals 5 minutes remaining after the 15-minute time limit, which they did for all their matches. I mean, you got five-minute updates.
I really, really like that.
Which New Japan does to this day as well. So that when you were going to tease – they did this on that Clash show where you feel they're going to go the full 30 minutes and then the finish comes out of nowhere like 28 minutes into the match. And it added more drama because I think today – you're so accustomed that if they bring up the time limit, you figure they're going the limit.
Yes, exactly. And that's just it's just these little things that you create that can add drama to the match just by like making it in every single match it happens, you know? Like checking the masks and stuff. Maybe sometimes they get caught for the masks. Maybe sometimes they catch the thing. You know what I mean? Maybe they don't even use the mask. Maybe they don't use twin magic. Like you gotta make every countouts as well, they do that in the Fed, where it's like if they start counting, it's going to be at 9. And then sometimes in NWA, they'll get in at 6, which you're just kind of conditioned as a WWE fan, like, oh, they're going to get in at 9. There's all these little things.
Dr. Death showed up at ringside, and Rotunda hits a suplex, and Dr. Death then rings the bell to confuse Rick Steiner, thinking he won, even though Teddy Long had not even gotten down to count. So Rick Steiner stops his cover, assuming this is a new way to win matches. Mm-hmm. And Tommy Young then comes down to talk to Teddy. The cage gets lowered, so Kevin Sullivan gets out. And the way this is structured, the audience completely must be believing Rick Steiner is getting fucked. There's no way he's escaping this without that happening. So Rotunda then misses Steiner, knocks Kevin Sullivan off the apron. Steiner gets the fall as both Young and Teddy Long count 3. And I am not exaggerating. I am literally exaggerating. This arena exploded.
Sullivan. And Rotunda just ran into Sullivan. Cairo Press. Rick Steiner has just become the new World Television Champion.
It was a huge pop. It was like
the biggest on the show so far, easily.
Oh yeah. I thought biggest on the show because especially like since the crowd was so excited they get to do their fun noise they like too. And so it's double. And I want to say when Dr. Death walked out, it was like you watch the show and you're like, oh shit, it's over. Because this, like, you can see Rick Steiner beating up Mike Rotunda, but then you see Dr. Death walk out. Like, well, he can't beat up a fridge that can move. Like, Dr. Death, I think they said earlier he's 6.
That would have been his gimmick under Jim Hurd.
you're a fridge, but you're tough. But Dr. Death, I think, is like 6 years into wrestling at this point. I didn't really realize how long he had wrestled before this. But, like,
Rick Steiner, you're saying.
No, Dr. Death.
Oh, Dr.
Sorry.
Death. Okay,
apologies. I didn't really realize how long Dr. Death had been wrestling, but like, is there a reason why this guy didn't really take off in the States, or he just made too much money in Japan?
It was just the Japan dates made it just – this was such a second priority to him that – I mean, he had an incredible setup over in All Japan and – just that loyalty factor over there. I mean, he was making so much more that he couldn't make WCW his main commitment, which was, you know, a point at that time. There were a lot of guys that were kind of double dipping at the time that Japan and other places were just paying so well. And Dr. Death fell into that because I'm sure had Japan not been the outlet for him, he would have been a significant guy during this time, especially into the early 90s where him and Gordy and the kind of guys that they would have had. But it's just Japan was just too lucrative for them.
Yeah, because he's a size – it's not even a size thing. It's like he's a different type of size than you're used to because you see Luger later on the show and he's very much what you're used to. It's like a guy who's really muscular and really cut and whatever. But then Dr. Death is like – he's just so wide. It's kind of like – it's like three rhinos. It's insane.
Then from there, we go – a match went 18 minutes. So, I mean, it was really the finish that this crowd went insane for. We followed that with the United States title match involving Barry Windham, which was just a couple months before he would be leaving the company, accompanied by J.J. Dillon to take on Bam Bam Bigelow with Sir Oliver Humperdinck, which I was trying to think about this earlier. Bam Bam is one of the few guys I think you can look at that in the same year appeared at WrestleMania and Starrcade.
Yeah.
I think Jarrett did it in 99, and I'm sure there are others that people will alert us to. But yeah, Bam Bam was in the tournament in Atlantic City that year and then came over to the NWA and wasn't around much longer after this because he would spend most of 89 working in New Japan.
And you get the prime of a lot of these guys. Like I was talking to Nauseam about Dr. Death, but Bam Bam too, like he's so athletic here. Is that why he was a babyface at this time? Because like they were just like, well, this guy's too athletic to be a heel. Like no one's going to hate him. Even though if you look at the guy for 80s style, like he's covered in tattoos. He looks mean as hell. Of course he'd be the heel.
Yeah, I feel that was the thinking was just you also needed an opponent, and just on the babyface side probably fit in a bit easier just for guys they were slotting for babyface positions. But also, I mean, Bam Bam Bigelow to me was like as a young fan. I mean, he was one of my first wrestlers that I really gravitated towards.
Really?
And just loved watching him. I thought the look was awesome, and the fact he could do shit off the top rope to me was just. For an 8-year-old, I was just transfixed with this guy. I was a massive Bam Bam Bigelow fan.
I remember when they were like, oh, he headbutts people because he's got tattoos on his head. And I just being like, that makes sense. His head's probably the strongest part of his body. Exactly. Look at all those tattoos.
Barry Windham is an interesting guy to watch because maybe a decent comparison is Randy Orton, that technically super sound. And when he is motivated, like a lot of people throw shit at Randy Orton, and I'm typically a pretty big fan of Randy Orton, but there's matches where it's just he doesn't bring his opponent up to his level. He'll work to the level he's in with. And with Wyndham, like you got nights where he looked like the greatest worker in the entire world.
Absolutely.
And then you had other nights where he just felt like he was just getting by on his natural athleticism.
Other than one specific thing where it's like, I think I just saw a split screen of Randy Orton and Jinder Mahal. Randy Orton versus Jinder Mahal.
Get ready, Chicago. Backlash.
In 2002. Sorry, 2002. 2012 versus Randy Orton, Jinder Mahal in 2017. And one thing you can't take away from Randy Orton, he cares a hell of a lot more about his physique than Barry Windham did.
Yeah, Barry Windham.
He
was enjoying life.
Yeah, Barry Windham looks like a man just in November who is like, I'm not going to have to take my shirt off for 4 more months. Let's get this turkey down.
Yeah, he to me is one that, I mean, in particular in the late 80s, I mean, he had some of those incredible matches with Ric Flair. And he, to me, is one of those huge what-ifs that if this guy had everything in order, what kind of a talent he could have been throughout the 90s.
Oh, absolutely.
That I think was potential that was largely missed.
Oh, absolutely. He he also like kind of hot-shotted territories a lot. Where it's like, you remember him here, mostly he's an NWA guy because he did hold that title. But he really spent like 2-3 years and he would go to WWF and then just like be in a tag team and then go back to
WCW. And had a lot of shit gimmicks in the WWF, like Widowmaker, the Stalker, the Blackjacks. I mean.
Yeah, the new Blackjacks was really like, that was just, the new anything isn't going to work. I guess, except for New Midnight Express.
Like he felt like a better fit for the NWA style of professional wrestling at this time.
Absolutely.
Than becoming a character in the WWF.
Yeah, well, absolutely, because you didn't have – everyone didn't – wasn't just cut to hell in the NWA.
Sure.
You had different body types, which is like he's fine to go against a guy like Bam Bam Bigelow or Luger because you still have guys like Ivan Koloff wrestling, you know?
Right, yeah.
Where it's like, yeah. But like here – and they even do some power moves with him because he's like 6'5", and they're like, oh, he's tall, so that means he's strong. It's like, all right, guys.
The match began, and Jim Ross says that the fans have really hit their stride here. I guess it's to say the finish of the TV title match finally woke some of them up.
Yeah.
I mean, this was not a rabid crowd up until that point. I mean, not dead by any stretch, but that was, you know, the big reaction was that title change.
Yeah, I think if you're looking at this, you're kind of disappointed that this is your crowd for Starrcade, but by the same token, this is a good crowd. Make no mistake.
Windham working with a black glove on his right hand, and the crowd was heated as Bigelow was in control early. He kept popping up. The audience was really into Bigelow, and Windham's retreating to the floor. Bigelow eats punches, and Windham's just – he was playing a very good heel here, begging off, and the crowd was reacting to all of Bigelow's big power moves. Windham finally throws Bigelow to the floor, and Bigelow hurts his knee landing on the cement, and then – there's a slingshot into the ring for a splash onto Windham, but it doesn't stay on him for the count, and the announcers just got on Bigelow for making such a stupid calculated error. Why wouldn't you go for the pinfall? They just turned on Bigelow here.
It's great. It's great. That's the style of this stuff where it's like, well, it's got to all make sense. So
Bigelow then missed a splash from the top, and Windham nailed him with a lariat. A dropkick sends Bigelow to the floor. He applies the claw on the ring and brings Bigelow down to his knees, but makes it for the rope break. Windham then delivers a scoop slam, misses the big elbow from the top, and they both fly over the top to the floor. Bigelow runs into the post, and Windham sneaks into the ring, beating the count. So your big Starcade finish is a count-out win for Windham at 16 minutes and 15 seconds. And Jim Ross, if this wasn't a telltale sign of where we see Bigelow going, cited the conditioning factor as the big difference here, where Barry outworked Bam Bam, the babyface.
Absolutely fantastic.
This fat ass could have gotten the shape for this match. It was like Jim Ross did a 180 when he didn't go for the cover.
It was just like, that's what commentators do. You got to tell the story of the match. The thing I never understood why countouts are generally known as like kind of like a blue ball finish for people. Like, I don't understand that, because to me, a count is like, well, the guy was out. You had him out for 10 rather than 3. I always thought that. I still kind of think it now. And I really like this finish because it goes towards the Barry Windham character where it's like he'll just outsmart you.
Yeah, I think people they want to see a definitive winner and a loser, and a count out feels like a way out where it's a guy's really not diminished by a count out loss. It's just simply,
yeah, like,
well,
you said,
I was faster than you.
Yeah. But like you said, this is a weird match because Wyndham's going to out the door and so is Bam Bam in like short order.
Yeah, both wouldn't be around long. And I got to say, this match was fine. But when I was looking at like the card for this was one match I was looking forward to seeing because I like both of these guys. What did you think of the match overall?
I liked it a lot. Like, kind of like what you said, I just thought it was good. I just thought it was a good match.
Yeah.
It's in the middle of the card, so it didn't really have any. Like you said before, Windham kind of does what he needs to do. Like, if he's in the final match going an hour, you're going to remember that hour. It's going to be amazing. If he's in the middle of the match, Barry's cutting out early to get some beers. Like, Barry don't care.
Extra props here to Dylan, who is doing all of this. Minus notes, which is impressive, I've got to say. Remarkable. Your recall here is
you
incredible.
You see Starcade, you remember Starcade.
You don't forget True Grit or the second T. Magnum TA is backstage with our man Rick Steiner. And Rick says, every dog has his day, and today was my day, December 26th. He says he left his dog Spike at home because pit bulls cannot fly on airplanes.
No, they cannot.
So even back then, pit bulls getting a bad rap from the mainstream media.
He does this, by the way, scratching his ear the whole time, like a pretty accurate version of a half man, half dog.
He has fleas after the Varsity Club attack.
Exactly. How come no one's really worn amateur wrestling headgear other than him and Kurt Angle? I thought he looked great here.
It's such a goofy look, but with Rick Steiner, it was never goofy.
Yeah, he
pulled
off
it was done
so
for comedy.
Much stuff. Yeah, exactly, right? But Rick Steiner here, you can really sense, like, as silly as it sounds, why Dusty wanted to kind of put the title on him or, like, feel it out, because he is so over here.
I didn't see him at world title level. I think this was about the position you would want him at this time, because
yes.
I still think he was really...
It's too goofy a gimmick.
Exactly.
You can't have, like,
it was too
oh,
comedy.
Here's our world champion, this guy who's pretending to be mentally handicapped.
Yeah.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah, which I guess the other... lesson throughout the Rick Steiner career is that that handicap can be corrected.
Exactly. Because 1999 Rick Steiner is probably, if you want to talk about Barry Windham not caring, a man not caring is 1999 Rick Steiner. How he would say, you don't like me, bite me. Like, in one weird whisper breath was one of the best things about WCW.
They sent pit bulls onto Sting.
Oh, yeah.
At a pay-per-view.
They reformed the Varsity Club at that time. That's how you know you're out of ideas. We're like, what's Mike Rotunda doing?
Let's go back to the Varsity Club.
Exactly.
The Road Warriors versus Dusty Rhodes and Sting for the NWA tag titles, which this one was going to be interesting because Dusty, clearly the signs were there that this guy was not long for the NWA.
Yeah.
And it was probably a chore just getting him onto this show and doing a finish in this way. I mean, this was your match second from the top. You had just done a count out finish, and now we were going to get a DQ finish. But man, were Rhodes and Sting over.
Yeah, they were really over. And I must say, I really feel bad for Sting in this match, because it's like one guy who wants to be able to go and can't, and then the Road Warriors, who I'm assuming are super hard to work with at this time just by watching a bit of the match. And it's like Sting's the only guy who's like, let's do it, guys. You know what I mean? It's kind of like you come in for your first day at work, but it's at a government job where everyone's like, no one cares here.
How did you like the Road Warriors as heels here?
I love them. But the thing is, their whole gimmick is basically what would make you a heel.
Right.
So I feel like there's this weird lapse where it's like any of these guys like trying to be heels. Like they only try Goldberg for a second, but like it's like Lesnar being a heel where it's like you want to like them so much because it's so fun to watch them kick ass.
Yeah. And I mean, the big angle here, which we went over, was the attack on Dusty, which I mean, by this point, I mean, a lot of the crowd was turning on Dusty and
yeah.
Dusty never wanted to really do that turn. And it was trying to get sympathy on Dusty, but this was hardly the case of, you know, for instance, breaking his ankle ahead of the 85 Starrcade, where it was that kind of revenge Dusty was going for, and everyone was behind him with Flair. But in this case, like, I don't think Dusty's heart was in any of this, especially he's not booking this at this point. He's on his way out, and it was...
And there's only so many times you can do the exact same thing.
Yeah, I mean, Dusty had ran his course in this company, both as a booker and realistically as a performer. While business wasn't tremendous in 89, they needed some fresh faces, and not just in the babyface term, but just your Steamboats, your Funks, like getting some new blood in there to refresh your main event scene.
To kind of defend the man, though, it's really, really trying. Can you imagine, like, this is probably a bad example, but can you imagine, like, let's say something happened to Roman Reigns, like, who would be, like, the Magnum TA of now? Something happened to Roman Reigns a couple years ago, and you're Triple H, what would you do? You'd be like, I guess I'm already star, so I'll stay back in, and that kind of seems like the same thinking Dusty had.
Well, that's also, I mean, that's, to me, whenever you're a booker, and you're also doubling as a performer, that's really tough, because you're the guy you can rely on, and it becomes very tricky to be a successful booker while you're still an active performer, and especially as a key performer on the show every week.
It's you're trusting someone else other than yourself. It's the same thing as running a business but not being the manager almost.
Yeah, and there's the burnout factor too. I mean, he had been booking now for years at this point, and you were recycling a lot of programs. He had really relied on his typical title change, not title change finish.
Yeah.
And that's just where he was at this point. I mean, I don't think it was a bad idea replacing Dusty as booker at the time, but they ran into a lot of problems when George Scott became the booker, and you maybe could have made a better choice of who you went with at that point.
100%. It's one of those things where as a booker, and Paul Heyman ran into it too, where it's like you don't have 2 weeks off. You don't get 3 months off. Like, oh, cool, go finish my storylines, that guy. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
So you would want, like a finality of the Starrcade.
That was the strength of Memphis, was just the Lawler and Jerry Jarrett had their 6 months on, 6 months off. And that was key to those guys, was having that end in sight when you were probably getting near that burnout phase and getting a break then.
Of course.
And getting a new, fresh set of ideas in there.
Of course. But, like, being a top in any industry, being a champion, being, like a director, being anything in any field of arts, you have to have this – you have to want it really badly. And Dusty really wanted it. And and part of wanting it is still wanting to always have it too. Like, have that power, have that say.
The Warriors charged the ring, quickly got sent to the floor. Crowd's going nuts before the ring introductions. They got the advantage on Sting. Rhodes comes in. They're going nuts for just everything that Dusty is doing here. I mean, this seemed like a pretty pro-Dusty crowd in Norfolk. Hawk then stomped Sting down in the corner. Sting landed this wild right hand. Warriors got the heat on Sting. Animal dropped him throat first on the top rope. Sting no-sells that and fights back. Then we had Dusty wrap Animal's leg around the post twice, which he emphasized here that he had crippled this man. Dusty then goes for the figure four. He gets poked in the eye, the injured eye, these pricks. Hawk takes him to the floor, thumbs him in the eye. Great selling, I thought, by Dusty of the eye.
Dusty is such a good seller, because in this match, you look at – you don't even have to – like, first impression to someone just watching this match, it's like, why is this nice old man trying to fight these two superhuman guys with the help of, I'm assuming, his daughter's boyfriend?
Hawk then applies a sleeper onto Dusty. He gets out of that with a jawbreaker. And then Sting comes in, hits the splash to Animal, applies the Scorpion Deathlock, which Hawk then breaks up and attacks him, tosses Sting over the top. Dusty hits a low blow to Animal, and then there's a high cross by Sting when Paul Ellering yanks Tommy Young to the floor and avoids the count of three, and the bell gets called at 11:19, and we get a DQ finish, and it ended with Sting and Dusty clearing the ring, and then they hugged, and... For viewers at home and those in the arena, like, this was kind of the send-off because Dusty didn't show up for dates in January and was gone a few weeks later, as was his nearly $600,000 salary.
It's kind of a weird send-off, obviously, what you wouldn't want for Dusty Rhodes. And I think, honestly, if you're going to do obviously it's not like a planned send-off, but if you're going to do a send-off, I think this is a great idea to have Dusty in a match like this, but I would say... Almost not. You have to find a place in between where Junkyard Dog and Dusty Rhodes is here for him to put him in here at the card, you know, just so he can be the star of the match. Like, no other stars except for Dusty. He's just kind of running roughshod over everybody.
Do you have the belief of giving Dusty kind of a big kind of hero send off here, knowing where things are going? Or do you feel, especially given he was a booker, do you feel that he should have lost at the end? On his way out. Where do you
think?
I think you can argue either way.
Yeah, I think you give him the big hero send-off. Like, I think the guys you can make off the back end of Dusty, especially if you're looking at the talent here right now, is kind of minimal. And people will know. People would kind of know. If he was doing a big send-off, it would become way more about Dusty than it would be if maybe Sweet Stan Lane beats him.
Oh, wow. And then just dances with Dusty.
And then, yeah, makes love to Dusty in the middle of the ring.
All right. And it's our main event time here as Ric Flair took on Lex Luger for the NWA heavyweight title. They had gone into – I mean, Flair was a heel in 88. But if you watch the promos on TV going into this, like, this was just two guys respecting one another. Luger training extra hard for this title rematch after the Great American Bash, which – we should go over right now. They did it in Baltimore, and the way they had set it up was that blood was banned in Maryland to do. So they worked an angle with the commission where they said, Luger's going to blade, but then you guys can stop the match. And the fucking commission is like, cool. So when Luger blades, there's hardly any blood, and the match gets called, and everyone hated the finish. So Luger, everyone thought he had won the match when they call it, and then it's the blood stoppage, and this was the big rematch to... Luger's second opportunity to win the title back.
Yeah, and I think Lex Luger...
This was like peak Luger.
That's so weird to think because I just look at Lex Luger as like, I guess.
He was really hot in 1988.
It could have been Lex
and
Luger.
And drew well.
It could have been Lex Luger. Could have been Mason Ryan, you know? It's just like a guy with a look. I don't know. I was always kind of down on Lex Luger.
I think it...
He should have never beaten Ludwig Borga, and I've carried that with me for the last 24 years.
Ross says that Lou Thesz is in the building, and Ross says that some might think he's the greatest champion, but I believe Ric Flair is the greatest champion. Really hitching his wagon to one Ric Flair here. They announce a 45-minute time limit, and the title can change hands on a disqualification.
That's always big.
Which I will say, given the prior two finishes where we had a countout and a DQ, it kind of did lead itself into this match where... It's selling the stipulation that this DQ, if what happens in the last two matches happens,
yeah,
title can change here. Ross also notes that Luger is down from 275 to 262 and clarifies he is not sick. This is a planned weight loss for Lex Luger.
He's cutting weight for no reason.
I love this. Like, he was slimming down to go match his cardio with that of Ric Flair for this 45-minute time limit.
I kind of like – this is kind of nitpicky, but I don't like how – If in the NWA, obviously they want to be like more like actually, like it's a shoot, blah blah blah, whatever. I don't like how they don't. If a real fight's announced, they talk about everything. Especially if it's a huge fight, even the referee choice.
Yes.
And like it seems like they would announce the title can change hands on the DQ, like build that up months beforehand, you know? Or maybe because Flair's not with JJ here, is he?
He is with JJ.
Okay,
here.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, then, I mean, we'll talk about that for months in advance. Like, this is a huge deal, you know, and WWF, WWE is huge for that, where they just announce like, oh, and by the way, it's no DQ now.
Yeah. Luger clotheslined him to the floor. Flair is just stunned by this. And we finally got a shot of Lou Thesz. And sitting a few seats down from him was Jim Herd. And I don't know for sure. This might have been the first time Jim Herd was ever shown on WCW on a broadcast.
What do you think Lou Thesz would want to say to Jim Herd? Just try and rip his throat out, wouldn't he?
Lou, I've got some ideas here. Can I bounce them off?
Okay. You're a mad scientist, Lou. And you can fly.
Lou Thesz also being the guy that didn't even want to be booked on cards with women.
What?
He felt they were gimmicks. He didn't want to be booked on cards with the women.
That's insane.
So I don't know if the Jim Herd era would have necessarily gelled with Lou Thesz's vision of pro wrestling in 1989.
Oh, my God. And I took his side against Buddy Rogers all these years. I thought he might have just not wanted to be like he's.
Now, he did work on cards with women. I mean, he wasn't, you know.
But he was just like.
Walking out on shows. But yeah, that was his thing.
I might work with them, but I'm not going to shake their hand.
Flair got Irish whipped arm first into the turnbuckle and starts selling his arm as Luger targets the left arm with a hammerlock. Luger just no-sells these chops and chases Flair to the floor, wraps his arm around the guardrail, and then his shoulder is sent into the post. Luger applied a figure four. Flair gets out, and then Luger's attacking with punches in the corner and accidentally nails referee Tommy Young, who flies down. And if there is a unsung hero on this show, it was Tommy Young.
Tommy Young is
one of the best refs.
Yeah, I've heard it said by other people who work with the man, but he is absolutely fantastic. And if you can watch any Tommy Young match, watch after I tell you this, he always misses the interference. And it sounds like really obvious, like, of course he misses the interference, but
it was notable throughout this entire card.
But he always just barely misses it, like, in a really believable way. He doesn't turn his back for 10 minutes while someone slowly gets a chair and hits him in the back. It's like, he turns his back, the guy hits him with a chair, he turns around, he just missed it. Fantastic.
Flair is thrown over the top in the corner. It's all Luger. He's constantly going for falls. He calls for the torture rack. And then Dillon gets on the apron, and Luger goes after him. Flair trips him with Young's back turned, going to Dillon's point, and attacks the left knee of Luger with a chair as Dillon is distracting Tommy Young. Flair targets the knee. Luger swears and is censored on the network version.
Oh, yeah.
Man. Flair then applies a figure four. Everyone's chanting Luger. He fires up, tries to turn Flair over, and does it, and the hold gets relinquished. Flair's then tossed off the top. Luger makes his big Superman comeback, applies the torture rack, but the knee buckles, and Flair lands on top, puts his feet on the ropes for leverage, and gets the pinfall. 30 minutes, 59 seconds, and Tommy Young did not see the ropes being used.
Awesome, awesome stuff. And this is the thing, consequences, like I was saying earlier, consequences for stuff, like the leg hurts, so he can't do the torture rack, so he loses. Easy, easy consequences.
I thought this was one of Luger's better matches he's ever had. Flair was always a great opponent for him. They drew really well in 1988 together. I mean, this wasn't a smashing success, Starrcade, but I think this was a much better option than 6 minutes with Rick Steiner in a cage.
Lex Luger also, it would be remiss to say, this man looks out of this world. Like, just insane on this show.
A lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into
this
physique.
A lot of blood, sweat, and tears. Like, this guy is...
Is he our Putski winner on this show?
He's got to be the Putski winner for the next 7 shows.
That's saying something, because Luger's always a big favorite to win, but rarely is he on a card that also featured the Road Warriors. But,
especially the
80s Road Warriors. He was 262 here and not sick.
It was 262 and not sick.
Cut 262.
I like the idea of him using traditional 80s steroids, but also weight cutting just for no reason. Just, why not? Why not ruin my kidneys just a bit more?
Ross and Cottle put over Luger as a future champion. State he hasn't even reached his peak yet. He was only 30 at this point. And Gary Michael Capetta plugs the upcoming, your favorite, Bunkhouse Stampede. So get ready, folks. Magnum TA then interviews Ric Flair and J.J. Dillon backstage. He calls it the toughest sport. People saw the best competition for the past 3 hours and puts over the NWA as the best.
For 3 hours! People around the world saw the best competition in a man's sport, the National Wrestling Alliance. And Ric Flair, once again, call it luck, call it the grace of God, toss the scab off the end of my chin, whatever you want to call it, I'm standing here. I never claimed to play this game by the rules. I play it Ric Flair's way, and that's throwing at all costs. And here I am, and I'll tell you, and the Crocketts, and Ted Turner, and anybody else that doesn't like it, to get this, you gotta beat this. Bottom line.
He never claimed to play by the rules. He plays by his own. And Luger will never wrestle Ric Flair for the title again. Fuck you, Lex. I've beaten you twice. And then Schiavone says that the NWA grew from various territories into a national power and asks where it will now go in the 90s. Believe me, Tony, you didn't want the answer to that. And he recaps all of the matches and they go off the air plugging their next pay-per-view, which would be the Chi-Town Rumble for Monday, February 20th.
A Monday?
This was a Monday. Dude, the Starrcade.
Jeez. Well, I mean, that's absolutely insane. And what you want to say here is, like, Ric Flair's promo at the end is so good. And I really enjoy how he's the world champion. And that also means you're the spokesman for that company.
Yep.
Like, although it is kind of weird because Hulk Hogan's just saying, say your prayers, I want to fight this guy. And Ric Flair's like, there's another company and we're better than that company, which kind of, I agree with, some people when they say, like, just don't talk about your competition.
Yeah. I mean, the NWA would,
they would always do that.
They threw them in all the time. Whereas WWF, I mean, it may be subtle what they would do. They would get into it more and more, like when they, like Rip Rogers, for instance, like mocking Dusty and stuff, or little things like Virgil.
But that's little things for like.
But NWA, fans, they came out and.
Yeah,
just,
they were like, we are better than him.
We have two pieces of feedback here we're going to go to before we wrap things up. The first one's from Christian. One of the things this show made me think about was why the business went with Scott Steiner over Rick Steiner in a singles role. Scott was the first to get a world title program and even a world title run, while Rick got very little in the grand scheme of things. I wonder why, as he was always weirdly over with the crowd, and I thought one of the biggest pops on the show was him winning the TV title. Another guy who I thought was overlooked a bit at this time was Barry Windham, who I thought was fantastic in his match. He was easily the second best of the night right after the main event, and shout out to the random guy in the audience who I spotted shaking his head in disapproval as Bam Bam went to the top rope. Couldn't help but laugh. Back to the main event, it was one of Luger's best ever, and that's not surprising since he was in there with Flair, who was, I think, the best in-ring worker at that time. Also, poor Teddy Long. The man didn't seem to get a break until later in the show, but I guess it was even when you consider how long Tommy Young was refereeing that main event. No excuses for that dreadful haircut, Teddy. Overall, I thought the in-ring was a little hit and miss, but the atmosphere made up for that tenfold. I give this a 7 out of 10.
Christian knows. See, Christian's talking about Rick Steiner. Let's all talk about Rick Steiner. How about that?
You felt that there was opportunity lost with Rick Steiner.
I really like Rick Steiner, and especially when you're a kid. When you're a kid, I mean, you want characters who are like, Rick Steiner's almost playing a kid who just likes dogs. So he's playing like a 3-year-old who likes dogs. I'm going to pretend to be a dog. Why not have him win some more matches? I don't know. I mean, obviously you can't be a serious champion with that gimmick of like, oh, I have an imaginary friend. But of course he's getting a huge pop at this time because wrestling's becoming more and more geared towards kids, like less Dusty being stabbed with spikes.
Could you have imagined like 93 Scott Steiner coming to the WWE when he did for his singles run in 2002 when he was just inflatable Scott Steiner?
Yes.
Like, imagine that 93 version of Scott Steiner a decade later with your Benoit's, Eddie's, Kurt.
Insane.
On SmackDown.
It would have been insane.
He would have been outstanding at that point. One more here from Jonas in Hamilton. I love this show. I'm so unfamiliar with 80s era WCW, NWA, and love it when you guys review these old shows. Well, thank Dylan for that. The atmosphere in the South is so entertaining and different from modern wrestling crowds. The haircuts. Dear God, the haircuts. No need for a Putski Award this week, because Luger, obviously. I think you need a new award for best hair. This one's got to go to Heyman. That mullet is unreal. But Randy Rose, Perry Windham, and Teddy Long give him a run for his money. Bob Caudle with JR, Heyman selling Cornette's punch like he was Mike Tyson, the fan flipping off Mike Rotunda, Flair's epic promo. The athleticism obviously isn't nearly as good as it is today, but the psychology, drunken, rambunctious crowd, and the simple way the product is presented makes this stuff a treat to watch. I'd love it if you guys did some big Smoky Mountain shows at some point. 8 out of 10. And a question. The Steiners were so awesome as a duo in this era, and Scott is, well, Scott. Do you ever see them getting their rightful Hall of Fame induction? Clearly they deserve it, but the whole world wants to see Scott do a speech. But does Vince? I feel the Steiners at some point. I mean, I feel everyone is up for the WWE Hall of Fame. It's just a matter of what they feel like.
Yeah, everyone thought Cornette was going to do something messed up. He's not going to do that. He respects his peers.
None of these guys are going to go
crazy. Yeah, no, and everyone needs money. That's the other thing. Like, I mean, I feel a certain kinship for people. Anybody who works like short-term contract jobs, be it like legitimately, be it comedian, be it pro wrestler, actor, anything like that, it's – you don't have any stability, so Scott Steiner is going to need money, and Vince McMahon's going to ask him to do something, and he's just going to do it because he – and then later shit on him and then create another form of income now for these wrestlers, which is just doing shoot interviews, be like, what was the catering like on Raw? Oh, it was good. They had a lot of cucumbers. Okay, cool. Here's $500, you know? It's just like – the it's just another form of revenue for these guys, and I think it's great.
Yeah, and I think that more and more – I mean, you look at American Alpha, and it's like they are – so clearly influenced by Steiner spots. I mean, that's really – that's their gimmick now, is that they are the Steiners 20 years later.
Yeah, and the Steiners were great. Rick Steiner was great, and Scott Steiner as the singles were great. It's honestly just like watching this Rick Steiner stuff, you really realize that, they were just like sustained really good for about 20 years, these guys.
Well, that's going to wrap up the show. Again, I want to thank you a lot, Dylan, for coming in, doing this review. This was a really fun review to go back to a very pivotal point in WCW's history and what would eventually come in 1989.
It was really fun. I highly recommend, because it's super easy to watch these if you watch all the NWA Spotlight stuff, because they pretty much start just before Starcade. So like the first ones on the network are just before Starcade, and you can watch the phone call. You can watch like – it's just like, the Road Warriors versus Dave. And then you can really see why everyone hated working the Road Warriors. Like, I think there's one match where first thing they do is they run in the ring. They throw some guy who just – the poor guy probably had to work the next day just onto the concrete on his head, and then beat up the other guy, just actually punching him in the face, and then just doomsday device and pin him.
There's one I watched not too long ago from, I want to say, 85, maybe around that time. And Ron Garvin just brutalizes this poor guy. I mean, he just came off as such an asshole in this match.
And it's just like, why?
Just destroyed this poor guy.
And the one thing I really like about squash matches is, like, now I get to see their finishing moves, which is really fun.
Yeah, so you can go check out your Eddie Sweats. A favorite at the time, Randy Hogan.
Randy Hogan.
Oh,
so good. If any guys want to follow a really fun account on Instagram, we're at The Wrestler Review, so it's like a podcast where you do like a – I'd say like an A&E biography of a wrestler. So it's not too in-depth. It's just about an hour and a half of talking about a wrestler and then mostly getting sidetracked, making fun of their early gimmicks. But it's the at Wrestler Review on Twitter and Instagram. And then there's also Jobbers and Jabronis on Instagram. It's absolutely fantastic.
Awesome. Anything else you would like to plug that's coming up for you?
I'll be back in the UK soon. So if anyone's in the UK and they want to see a man deal with what they call stag and hendus there, at the Frog and Bucket, April 27th, 28th, and then in London at the Up the Creek on, May 5th, and then Leighton Buzzard, May 6th. Leighton Buzzard, real town. Follow the buzzards, John.
Yeah. And we haven't talked about this, but we have come up with an idea that anyone that goes out to a future Dylan Gott show and you yell Stan Lane, he will do the dance on the
stage. That's guaranteed. After the show, please.
All right. Stan Lane. That's your code word. Thanks again, Dylan. We will be back in 2 weeks with a new review away. Myself and Way have to confer on what we are going to be reviewing in 2 weeks, and we will let you know over the next couple of days. We'll let you know Monday on Review of Raw what will be the next review. But that's going to wrap it up for us. Thank you for listening to Review Away. And is there any song that maybe inspired you on this show, Dylan, to take us out here?
There's only one song I want to hear, and that's the Midnight Express, like the theme song from the Midnight Express.
The WWE Network won't air it, but we certainly will. So here it is.
If you're hearing it for this first time, like, this is a great walking down the street song.
There you go. From coast to coast to the Midnight Express. Here you go.
Paulie Dangerously. It's no secret. Ever since I've been a professional wrestler, brother, I've been looking to win a fight. I've had 52 wrestling matches, ain't won one. I have been come out on the wrong end of quite a few fights, and I've even gotten knocked goofy by a girl. But, Paulie, let's set the whole thing straight. I finally found somebody I can whip. I'm going to stick this fist down to your throat so far, when I pull it out, it's going to have toenails sticking out of it, because you couldn't whip cream with an outboard motor, Paulie. And you just remember that. And you remember one more thing. When the whole thing's said and done, when they beat Condry and Rose, when I beat you, you just realize, Paulie, what you're going to feel like when the whole country, the whole world knows the first time in my life I ever kicked somebody's butt, it was yours.
All right, fans, we'll be back with the Commandos here on Superstation TBS in one moment.
We have witnessed here tonight 22 great athletes, 22 of the greatest athletes in the world. And, you know, in the 1980s, the NWA went from being a group of promoters from around the country, like in the Carolinas, Georgia, Kansas, all around the country, and Texas, to a national power. And as we go into the last year, 1989 of the decade, where does the NWA go? The NWA riding on the footsteps of truly the greatest champion of our time, Nature Boy Ric Flair.